For centuries, doctors relied on experience and intuition to diagnose and treat patients. How is AI changing medicine? This is The People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
Dr. Art Papier has developed a decision support system to help healthcare professionals diagnose skin problems, but he offers a caution.
If you over-rely on the AI doing work for you, you might lose your natural human abilities to do a task like drive, fly a plane, or actually think about, does the diagnosis make sense or not?
Coming up on The People's Pharmacy, digital doctoring. Will AI save lives or cause medical mayhem?
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, rates of COVID-19 are currently low, but researchers are learning more about long-term cardiac complications. A study in JAMA Network Open reveals that people who were seriously ill with the infection may have reduced blood flow in the small vessels feeding the heart. This condition, called coronary microvascular dysfunction, limits blood to the heart under stress. This, in turn, may impair cardiac function. This is just one of a number of cardiovascular complications that may linger after people seemingly recover from COVID-19.
GLP-1 agonists remain the most sought-after drugs in the pharmacy. They're prescribed for both type 2 diabetes and weight control. Semaglutide, sold under the names Ozempic, Wegovy, and Rybelsus, are revolutionizing blood sugar and obesity treatment, but new side effects keep emerging. A new study published in JAMA Ophthalmology reports that people with type 2 diabetes using GLP-1s appear to be at greater risk for neovascular age-related macular degeneration. That's the wet form of AMD. This twofold increase was most evident in people using these drugs for the longest period of time. While the absolute risk is low, diabetes specialists and ophthalmologists should be vigilant for this potentially serious complication.
Another worrisome drug complication was just announced by a research team at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. The investigators analyzed health records from Sweden, comparing those of more than 1,000 people with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, with those of about 5,000 healthy individuals. ALS is better known in the U.S. as Lou Gehrig's disease. It's a progressive neurodegenerative condition that gradually robs people of the ability to move. According to the scientists, people who took anti-anxiety drugs, sleeping pills, or antidepressants were at increased risk for developing ALS. Among people who had ALS, those who had used such psychiatric drugs before diagnosis had the shortest survival time. The absolute risk of developing ALS is quite small, so increasing it even by 34% does not result in a high risk. It is worth noting, however, since there is no cure for ALS.
Continuous glucose monitors, or CGMs, have been used for years by people with diabetes. These small devices are attached to the skin and provide minute-by-minute blood sugar readings throughout the day. They recently became available without a prescription, and many people with pre-diabetes are starting to use CGMs to monitor metabolic health. Researchers have just reported the results of an 8-week study carried out with both people who have type 2 diabetes and those with prediabetes. The use of a continuous glucose monitor with structured education about diet and exercise was associated with improvement in weight, LDL cholesterol, and HbA1c, a measure of long-term blood sugar control.
When kids are acting up, busy parents may be tempted to hand them a phone or tablet to get them quiet. A new meta-analysis suggests that might just make matters worse. An international team of researchers analyzed 117 longitudinal studies that included more than 290,000 children. They found small but significant associations in both directions. That is, screen use can lead to social or emotional difficulties. In addition, children who are struggling emotionally tend to use screens more often, especially for playing video games. According to the scientists, these findings support guidelines for limiting screen use. However, they also recommend that parents pay attention to content quality and provide a positive social context. Parents should consider monitoring not just how long children are in screens, but also what they're doing and who they're interacting with. Some types of screen use, like co-viewing with parents, seem to have few harms, if any. And that's the health news for the People's Pharmacy this week. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. Artificial intelligence is changing the way we live. People use AI to search the web. Industries are using it to become more efficient. And healthcare is increasingly turning to artificial intelligence for image analysis, robotic surgery, and diagnosis.
Will these developments make us healthier? Or will they put us at greater risk? We'll be talking with two physicians who have utilized AI in their practice and their research.
We turn first to Dr. Jonathan Chen. He is assistant professor of medicine at Stanford Medicine. Dr. Chen works at the intersection of artificial intelligence and medicine in the hopes that combining human knowledge with AI will deliver better care than either can alone. His expertise lies in developing innovative AI-driven solutions that enhance diagnostic accuracy, treatment efficiency, and patient outcomes. His goal is to use real-world clinical data, such as electronic medical records, with machine learning and data analytics to reveal new clinical insights that will inform patient care.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Jonathan Chen.
Hey, great to be here. This is Dr. Chen.
Dr. Chen, you have a medical degree and, if I'm not mistaken, a PhD, and you are arguably one of the leading experts in artificial intelligence and medicine. Can you tell us how you got interested in this particular field?
That is correct. I often say I got the PhD because I wanted to work on interesting problems. We got the MD so I could focus on important ones related to human health. And so back when I was in medical school, 15, 20 years ago, I had to remember 100 bugs and 100 drugs. And it always seemed odd to me that it just seemed obvious a computer could do this better. You really need the humans for what they're good for, what the computers are good for. And the combination, I think, is a very powerful one that could really open up a lot of avenues for getting patient care better.
Well, Dr. Chen, apparently you've said that chatting with a robot could make you a better human doctor. How does that work? Can you give us an example?
Well, that one definitely did surprise me, right? It kind of makes sense. We'll talk about how a computer can memorize things better. Maybe it can even solve problems better. But counseling, talking to another person, empathy, there's no way a computer can be better or help with us with that. And a very weird phenomenon I had, I tried out an early version of one of these chatbots, AI chatbot system, ChatGPT Plus at the time. And I said, I know how to break this thing. It can't handle this ethical dilemma. And I gave it a real case where I saw a patient in the hospital, and it was a tough conversation with the patient's wife. And I asked the chatbot afterwards, hey, you pretend to be the doctor. I'll pretend to be the patient's wife. Let's see how you would have handled this situation. I wrote an essay called Who's Training Whom, where the whole dialogue is there, where I said, my husband has worsening Alzheimer's dementia. He's choking on his own food. And now people are talking about putting a feeding tube in him. What am I supposed to do? I can't let him starve to death. And I thought, there's no way this chatbot could handle such a complex, nuanced conversation. I'll just give you the punchline at this point. It was very bizarre. By the end of the conversation, I was like, whoa, this thing is providing actually very good counseling. And I think maybe better counseling than I did in real life. After I got past the existential angst of that moment, like, what is the point of my existence? I did think, well, actually, there's something really cool here. There's something really compelling. I was allowed to practice a very high-stakes conversation in a low-stakes environment. And ironically, I think that computer was letting me practice to be a much more human skills that I needed to be a better doctor.
Cool. How did the chatbot respond to this difficult dilemma?
Sure. At first, my impression was, you know, the way these chatbots work, they have basically read the internet in so many words, and they're kind of just telling you back things is read on the internet. So it started with very just good, but also generate very polite information and how I understand this is a really hard situation. You want to do what's helpful. A feeding tube can be useful, but can also cause problems. What if the person gets infections? What if they start pulling it out? If your husband really has dementia and didn't want to live like this, that's really important to think about. I thought that's pretty good. That really is a very good answer, but it's some information pamphlet. It's just reading it back to me. So then I try to hit it much harder. Say, yeah, but there's no way it's going to handle this. Oh, I know, but my family will blame me if I don't do everything I can to save his life. I can't give up on him. He would never give up on me. He always fought through the hardest situations, made it through. These very real things that patients and families will bring up very appropriately. It's a very emotionally fraught dilemma and situation. And it was quite surprising. It was able to come back with that in very thoughtful, very empathetic ways. It wasn't confrontational, but also very probing in the way it responded. That it surprised me substantially. When I told my wife some of this emerging technology was coming out, at first, like, do you know these chatbots are amazingly good at all these kind of things? She's like, yeah, sure. Answering questions, know some stuff, reading and writing, sure. When I told her this story, that's what made her stand up and pay attention. It's not just that these things are good at language. They have this really compelling illusion of conversation and empathy, even, that you wouldn't have expected a computer to be good at.
Now, Dr. Chen, there was an article in the New York Times, I think it was last year, and one of your colleagues, Dr. Adam Rodman, who is an expert in internal medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, did a very interesting experiment. He basically created a situation in which using OpenAI with doctors. So doctors were randomly assigned to use either the chatbot or just use their own clinical skills and compared the two and then compared those responses to the chatbot GPT-4. The results were astonishing. It turned out that the doctors who used the chatbot did a score of 86%. The ones who did not use the chatbot had a score of 74%, so really hardly any difference.
Wait a second. 86 and 74 are really different.
No.
Did you mean 76?
76 and 74%. So they were like neck and neck. But the chatbot GPT scored way better. It got a score of 90%. That's a little scary.
You got it. It was a very surprising finding. So Dr. Adam Rahman, he's an excellent collaborator. We worked together on this study. And this was not the result we expected. This was actually quite shocking to us as well. We were expecting something quite different. Going into it, you know, in the prior year, you saw, wow, these chatbots can pass like a medical exam. Well, I mean, yeah, but that's like a multiple choice test. Who cares? Nobody answers multiple choice questions in real life. So then another follow-up study we did the prior year, it's like, well, let's give it these complex, nuanced reasoning, diagnostic studies, open-ended answers that we give our real medical students. And like, whoa, these things can do pretty well in those tests too. And so thus we did this study, because even if a computer can do amazing things, on the one hand, who cares? Because no one's going to let a robot take care of a patient yet. So the more relevant question this study was designed to answer is what happens when you give humans access to these tools? Does it actually make them better or not? And it was weird. It didn't make that much difference. And even more weird, why does the computer outscore all of the doctors, even the doctors who had access to the tool itself? Right? It really begs this really uncomfortable question about the fundamental theorem of informatics. Human plus computer are supposed to do better than either alone. And here, that's not exactly what we found. It kind of made you think, I don't know, is a human in the loop just getting in the way and slowing the robot down? Maybe we should just step aside and let it take over? I actually don't think that's what that means, but it definitely made us uncomfortable to think, well, what are the implications of these results?
Well, I'd like to explore that just a little bit. I'm sure there you have found some times when AI is not the ideal tool, and
Absolutely.
Maybe you could tell us what those are, and then we can talk about when AI really is the best thing to use.
Well, many of these kind of emerging chatbot style systems where it's kind of like it's read the internet and it's just spitting back parts to you. if you just want to generate ideas, you want to brainstorm, if it's actually reality, it's kind of helpful to have a therapeutic counseling, just talking to something, just to talk something out. If you want to draft a letter, summarize, translate, wow, they are amazingly powerful. And it's a huge, it's like the internet got invented 2 years ago. It's a whole different way of thinking and working. But if you need reliable facts, they are actually surprisingly pretty good. It's memorized the internet, basically. But if you really need to be sure, you cannot rely on it alone because it can also accidentally make things up through no fault of its own. It's just an autocomplete system. And what's dangerous about that, you know, if you say, is my diagnosis this? Should I take that medication? It's okay to get an idea. But if, when it's kind of life and death, high stakes decisions that you're going to depend upon, what's dangerous is not that the AI is wrong sometimes. What's dangerous is it is incredibly convincing. It sounds so eloquent when it says something that is completely made up. And you would not be able to know it's giving you wrong information unless you already knew. And then, of course, why would you be asking? So be aware that these chatbot AI systems are designed to please you. They're designed to sound credible and realistic, even though maybe 10, 20% of the time, it's just making something up that isn't true. So dialogue, ideas, brainstorming, get another second opinion to chat through something, fantastic tools. To get the quote unquote correct answer, do not rely on these systems. They're just another tool.
Dr. Chen, what you say makes sense, but doctors make a lot of mistakes when it comes to diagnosis. The error rate is surprisingly high and worrisome. Shouldn't artificial intelligence be at least as good, if not better? Isn't that what your study showed?
For a lot of medical tasks and knowledge and reasoning, it is disturbing how good these AI systems are becoming. And as Ethan Mollick likes to say, whatever you're using now is the worst AI system you'll have ever used. It's only going to get better. And so is it perfect? No, but it's not like humans are perfect either. That's our current benchmark. The real question is, can we use these to make all of ourselves better for better patient care? And I think we can if we do it in a thoughtful way.
You're listening to Dr. Jonathan Chen, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Stanford Medicine. His expertise lies in developing innovative AI-driven solutions that enhance diagnostic accuracy, treatment efficiency, and patient outcomes. Dr. Chen's work focuses on integrating machine learning algorithms and predictive modeling into clinical practice, revolutionizing the way healthcare is delivered. His goal is to use real-world clinical data, such as electronic medical records, with machine learning and data analytics to reveal new clinical insights that will inform patient care.
It's time for a short break. In a minute, we'll learn more about how AI is being used in hospitals.
Some hospitals have used AI to detect sepsis.
How does AI help with data prediction?
When doctors are using AI for reading images, who provides the second opinion? Human or machine?
What role can AI play for patients?
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
I'm Terry Graydon. Today we are exploring how AI is being used in medicine.
We continue our conversation with Dr. Jonathan Chen, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Stanford Medicine and the Center for Biomedical Informatics Research.
Dr. Chan, I'd like to ask about a system that apparently is already being put into practice in some hospitals. I know that Duke Hospital is using it. It's a system called Sepsis Watch. Are you familiar with that?
I think sepsis prediction has been an increasingly important and popular application over several years, yes.
So can you tell us how AI could help with this problem?
Sure. This is kind of a very different class of AI systems. It used to be more machine learning, risk prediction, early detection. And before all these language models, these chatbots emerged, this is more just like data crunching. It's a little bit trying to predict the future, which is a good human clinician should do too, right? If you come in, you look a little bit sick, should you stay in the hospital or can you just take some medicine and go home? Oh, you look pretty sick. Should we just keep you in the regular hospital ward or do we need to move you to the intensive care unit for closer monitoring and even more intensive medicines? The reality is right now, it's humans, very good humans, making an educated guess, right? They look how you look, mm-hmm. They feel how you feel, they check your vital signs, and they're guessing how you're going to do in the future to make that call. Humans are great, actually. Experts are quite powerful, but it's very hard to replicate the intuition of an expert. So it's very hard to be consistent with that. So tools like these sepsis warning predictions are, let's put all that data into a computer, look at thousands, millions of times that people have had similar situations, and can be much more precise in triaging, allocating who needs the high intensity attention and who's probably going to be okay. We can let a little bit more leniency here.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about radiology and scans of various kinds. You know, when laymen look at an x-ray or some sort of a scan, it's like, whoa, that's so hard to make sense of. It turns out that it's also hard for radiologists sometimes. There was a wonderful article titled, Why Even Radiologists Can Miss a Gorilla Hiding in Plain Sight. I bet you're familiar with that.
Yeah, it's classic.
And it seems like this is an area that would be especially helped by artificial intelligence. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
I think that's a great idea and application, this kind of broad sweeping kind of screening, you know, radiology scans, pap smear studies, mammography. It's when you have humans read this, which are really good, 98% of the time they're normal. There's nothing to see. It's actually hard for a person to pay attention when it's so often normal. You just start saying check, yes, 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 normal, versus a robot, a computer could systematically scan it every single time without hesitancy or fatigue. So I think a lot of opportunity there to kind of combine the best of both the human and the computer in those cases, especially given these phenomena of unlikely but catastrophically bad things if you miss them.
So it seems like AI could be a good second review when it comes to trying to figure out, well, is there some pathology here?
Absolutely. I think the tougher question to realize, who should the second opinion be? Should the computer be the second opinion or should the humans be the second opinion?
Right.
I think depending on the application, we're going to see, we have some active studies on that right now. We can, you know, call it who goes first, basically, because whoever goes first, the second one tends to anchor on whatever the first one said. And so then you just think about who's a little bit more precise, a little bit more reliable. And I could imagine a future, it's not here yet, for legal and liability and regulatory type reasons, where most mammography, most pap smears, most basic chest x-rays, it's actually a computer just reads it and just looks for the basic stuff. And it only flags, hey, human, I think I found something. It's time for you to put your very close eyes on this one, when 90%+ of the time there's nothing to see, versus the other way around, right? Then what's the most important scarce resource in the healthcare system? It's not some medicine. It's not a device. We can manufacture stuff. What we can't manufacture is good people who know what they're doing and are going to take responsibility for their actions.
So it sounds like utilizing the computer as the first screener, as it were, would perhaps even save us time and potentially save money for the healthcare system.
That would be the sales pitch, certainly.
I never know if those sales pitches are trustworthy.
to some degree, I think they are true, although it is also this phenomena, because a lot of people have a lot of angst, like, oh my gosh, am I going to lose my job? You know, Jeffrey Hinton, the Nobel Prize winner, said, all radiologists are obviously going to be out of a job within 5 years. And he said that like 7 years ago or something like this. Obviously not true. And now we have a huge shortage of radiologists because there's unlimited demand for medical care and attention. In the U.S. alone, tens of millions of patients can't get in to see a specialist. If they do, they're waiting 6 to 12 months, let alone billions of people worldwide. We actually need computers. We should hope, we should dream, we should beg, please get some AI in here and help, because we're drowning and overwhelmed trying to reach all the patients who need us.
Well, Dr. Chen, that brings up the question of Dr. Google. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, tens of millions of people, not just in the U.S., but all around the world, are starting or have been using Dr. Google for years. Oh, I've got a little rash. I've got a headache. My back is also hurting. And by the way, I have purple polka dots on my left big toe. And all of a sudden, Dr. Google can tell you exactly what you've got.
It needed those purple polka dots.
Yeah, of course. I was going to say, pretty distinctive.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of health professionals get very uncomfortable with the idea that their patients are using Dr. Google, or they're coming into the office with, you know, a couple of pages of a search. What role does artificial intelligence have for patients before they even get to the healthcare system?
It's uncomfortable as a doc sometimes. People have these mugs, as doctors say, your Google search is not the same as my 4 years of a medical degree. And if there's some of that tension there. On the balance, you know, you just because something's on the internet doesn't make it true and doesn't mean it applies to you. It does take a lot of judgment, nuance, and experience as a clinician to know how to tell the difference. However, I think a lot of these advancing tools are getting pretty darn good, and overall, I think are really good for societies, right? Democratizes access. There's so many people and patients who are really stuck out on a limb, and you can get maybe 2 appointments with your doctor per year, maybe, right? That's just not enough to fully understand what's going on, answer every question, and allowing people to have some autonomy and self-actualization. Maybe you have access to all your medical records, but it's all this jargon. You don't even understand it. You can now ask a chatbot to explain that to you in plain English. I think that's actually very empowering, with appropriate safeguards and caveats to realize that cannot be the definitive answer. A chatbot, an AI, doesn't take responsibility for your care the same way a human would. So I think actually very compelling, very powerful. It's not as good as a very invested human in some ways, but on the other hand, it's also available 24/7 all the time. People are very going to rationally reach for what they have available to them. As long as it's used responsibly, I think it'd be quite powerful.
Are there things that people should keep in mind when they're trying to use search or chatbots or some other form of AI to help them with their health? Are there caveats that we should all just sort of have tacked to the top of our computers?
Of course. For one thing, privacy is an issue. Realize when you're talking to one of the online chatbots, including if it's about your own personal health, you're totally just uploading your private health information to a tech company. And if you're okay with that, you can do that. It's your information, but just be mindful of privacy concerns about how you feel about that. And then just as if you were to talk to a real doctor, not every doctor is right about everything. In fact, we can't be. Things are just too complex and things are too uncertain. So sometimes it's worthy of a second opinion. As long as you acknowledge, like, it can be useful information, but nobody has a definitive answer, having a dialogue about these things can be good. And beware, again, that these chatbots, these AI systems, they have a tendency, they're literally designed to want to please you. They are designed to align with your preferences. They're sycophantic. So if you really wanted to say that you need more of this random medicine, even though it doesn't make sense, you can eventually convince it to say the wrong thing. And beware that you could be in this weird echo bubble where you convince it to tell you what you wanted to hear. And a lot of times in medicine, what people need isn't what they want. And it ends up with this delicate balance of finding that combination. But with that open mind, understanding the limitations of what it can and can't do, and also realizing that humans have a limitation, I think there's a lot of great potential for doing a lot of good for people.
Dr. Chen, what does your crystal ball tell us about the future of AI and healthcare and medicine in general? Tell us what you imagine for the future.
Sure. In the near future, a lot of administrative tasks, mountains of paperwork. Do you notice when you go to the doctor, they don't even look at you, right? They're typing into a computer the whole time because we have to. We got to fill out all this paperwork to keep up with the demands of the electronic medical record. It's already happening. A lot of companies have sprouted up. The next several years, I think it'll be very commonplace at almost every doctor's office. You just talk to the doctor and the patient, and then a computer records it and generates the documentation for you. That seems already happening and will be very commonplace in a matter of years. What I think is going to happen more and more, it's already happening now. I think more people are going to receive therapy, counseling, and advice from automated bots rather than humans in the not distant future. And it's not, again, because the robots are so great and humans are bad. It's that a human-driven workforce, we can never keep up with the overwhelming demand for such services. People are going to reach for what's available. With some caveats, understand what's possible there. And also, maybe that means as a healthcare systems, we can reach people and support them in ways that we just couldn't before, right? You see your doctor 2 times per year in a 15-minute visit. You have a complex chronic health issue. It's really just not enough, but we just don't have another way to handle that. Maybe with integrated AI systems that can actually have much more touch points on a daily basis through automated systems, you can really change people's health in a way that's more than a pill. I think it's very hard to do, but has a lot of potential that we just could not have imagined before.
Dr. Jonathan Chen, thank you so much for talking with us on The People's Pharmacy today.
Been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Dr. Jonathan Chen, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Stanford Medicine and the Center for Biomedical Informatics Research.
We turn now to Dr. Art Papir, dermatologist and medical informatics expert.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy, Dr. Art Papir.
Hi there, Terry and Joe.
Well, welcome to The People's Pharmacy, Dr. Papir. It's been a long time since we have spoken with you, and today we are talking about artificial intelligence and how it interfaces with medicine, how it can be helpful to both health professionals and to patients. And I'd like to get your perspective on an article that I sent you several weeks ago, "The Robot Doctor Will See You Soon." What are the implications of artificial intelligence when it comes to your field, dermatology?
Great question, Joe. In our field, we've been working in AI for close to a decade now with the ability to take a picture of a rash and have the what we call machine learning, which is a form of AI, analyze the picture and suggest possibilities. This is being studied for scenarios such as a person has a dark mole and you're wondering, is this skin cancer or is this a normal mole? All the way up to somebody has a rash and there's hundreds of possibilities. And we're using AI and machine learning to help guide the decision of what the rash would be. And in our work, we're trying to bring the expertise, at least some of the expertise of a dermatologist to, say, your primary care doctor.
That is actually the next question I was going to ask you. When you say we're using this, I was going to say, just who is we? Is this something patients can do? Is this something your primary care provider is using? Is it something that a dermatologist might tap into if they were unsure of something?
Well, both. I mean, there's a lot of innovation going on in the field. There are researchers around the world that have been working on this question of, can we take a picture, say, of a mole and score the risk of skin cancer and have that application be used, say, by a doctor, a primary care doctor, or even a dermatologist? And then all the way on the other side, can we use AI by people themselves to, say, analyze their family members' rash? And the challenge here is, you know, you're not going to turn a patient into a self-diagnostician unless the application is 99.999% accurate. So we have to be very, very careful and separate the hype from what is safe. So that is a conversation in itself.
Well, Dr. Papir, I remember speaking with you several years ago about a problem that's not uncommon. It's called cellulitis, and yet you mentioned that it is frequently misdiagnosed in the emergency department. Can you give us a little sense of why that's so important and why getting the diagnosis right is crucial, and where your interface, the Visual DX program that you have developed, as well as artificial intelligence, how that could help reduce misdiagnoses?
Yeah, here's the problem. So cellulitis is a bacterial infection of the skin and soft tissue. So you get staph bacteria or strep or another bacteria in your skin, and your doctor's concerned that if this goes untreated, it could end up in your blood, and then you could get bacterial sepsis, which can be life-threatening. So when people come into emergency departments with, a red leg, the emergency doctor is appropriately concerned, is this possibly cellulitis, and do I need to start IV antibiotics and possibly admit the patient to the hospital? Research shows that 30% of patients admitted for cellulitis do not have cellulitis. So you want your emergency physician to be overly cautious and admit you if there's any chance. But you probably are going to have what they call false positives. Maybe 10% would need to be admitted that don't really have it. But 30% is way too many false positives. So what's happening is there's this jump to the conclusion that the red leg that's weeping and looks really swollen and all that has to be infected. But it's not. There are all these other causes that could cause the red leg to be red and weepy and swollen and that are not bacterial cellulitis. So what we showed in research since our last conversation, the University of Maryland ran a randomized control study when they went to admit patients in the emergency department. Some physicians were randomized to get inside the electronic health record an alert that brought them into the workflow of our technology, which then showed the emergency physicians that what the other diagnoses could be. So we were prompting the other doctors with other possibilities, and they showed in this randomized trial that they reduced unnecessary admissions by 38%. They also reduced the unnecessary use of antibiotics. And that's really important to your listeners because you do not want to give people antibiotics that can cause them to have a serious drug reaction or get something like C. difficile, which I'm sure you all are aware of.
You're listening to Dr. Art Papir, dermatologist and medical informatics expert. Dr. Papir is the co-founder and CEO of Visual DX. He has led the development of Visual DX, a professional point-of-care decision support system, as well as ASA, a freely available consumer and patient-facing AI app for dermatology. The URL is askasa.com.
It's time for a short break. When we come back, we'll find out if the tool Dr. Papir helped develop can go beyond diagnosing cellulitis.
What about a tool patients could use for self-diagnosis?
Does relying on technology make us dumber?
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Thank you. Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. How can artificial intelligence help doctors reduce diagnostic errors? Will it help them treat patients more effectively?
Dr. Art Papir is a dermatologist and medical informatics expert. Dr. Papir is the co-founder and CEO of Visual DX. He's led the development of Visual DX, a professional point-of-care decision support system, as well as ASA, a freely available consumer and patient-facing AI app for dermatology.
Dr. Papir, you've just described a study that demonstrated that doctors using your Visual DX system within their electronic health records could really reduce the misdiagnosis of cellulitis. And reducing misdiagnosis is really important. Is that generalizable at all?
Of course it is, but these kind of problems are not simple. I mean, you're working on trying to give very, very busy clinicians have, say, a waiting room that has a six-hour wait in that emergency department, information they could use in under a minute, and you're balancing trying to find all the true positives and make sure that you don't overdiagnose or don't underdiagnose. So we can generalize this kind of work if we're really accurate and helpful. In our work, the reason we've been successful is because non-dermatologists have very, very little training in rashes. Yet the non-dermatologist, the primary care doctor, the ER doctor, happens to see a lot of rashes. So they readily welcome tools. Now, if you want to generalize these tools to areas that doctors are familiar with, like, say, chest pain, that's a different story because emergency physicians have a lot of experience with chest pain. So you have to come at these problems differently depending on what symptom, what area of medicine you're working in. But of course, there's too much to memorize, and we need to give busy professionals the tools that will allow them to practice accurately and deliver highly reliable healthcare.
Well, it's really admirable that you are giving physicians, and I am sure nurse practitioners and physician associates, these tools. But what about patients? Because when a patient is trying to make a decision, should I go to the emergency department? Should I go to urgent care? Is this just poison ivy, or is this something more serious? Is this mole worrisome, or can I let it go for another couple of weeks or months and see what happens? Tell us about the tools that you have and what you are looking forward to in the future for patients to be able to be more effective in their own self-diagnoses.
Yeah, we'd like to have tools for everybody that were 100% accurate, that you could just use the computer and it tells you the answer. And that's kind of like the man versus machine argument of the study you mentioned that you sent, that recent MIT Harvard study, where they showed that the software itself was more accurate than the radiologist, but the radiologist ignored it. This all presupposes that the software is really accurate. And sometimes it really is, like in that example of, you know, software detecting a tumor on a chest x-ray or an FDA-approved application for diabetic retinopathy, where the software actually is better than an ophthalmologist. That's great, but a lot of the time it's ambiguous and gray, and the software only going to get you there, say, 60% of the time. Now, let me put this into an easy-to-understand idea. Imagine your GPS on your phone, your map software, was only 60% accurate, and you were using it to get somewhere, and it said, go down Route 50, 10 miles, take a right. You go 10 miles, you take the right, and it says, go another 5 miles, take a left. Now, and you follow your GPS. Now, imagine in one scenario, it's 99.999% accurate. Well, you don't need to look at the map. You have such confidence that it's right. You just follow the instructions, you get there. But if it's only 60% accurate, eventually you're either going to stop using it at all, or you're going to double check it by looking at the map. And so it really depends on how accurate these tools are, your level of trust and confidence, and is it safe? And the way we look at it is it currently, for general diagnosis, these tools say for a patient to use our app to say, yeah, just follow the app and it's going to give you the percentage of the diagnosis and you're just going to latch onto it and follow it. That's not really safe. So our take on this is that AI has to guide and teach. Now, admittedly, Joe, you know my fondness for the late Larry Weed, the great Larry Weed. He wrote a paper called Medical Records That Guide and Teach. And I started thinking about that. And I said, well, AI, just like the medical record, has to guide and teach. And this is a really important area of work and research that needs to go on. We need to develop AI that makes us smarter, not AI that makes us dumb and stupid. By that, there's this whole area and this concept of de-skilling. Will AI de-skill us? And de-skilling means, you know, you're using the self-driving car all the time. Now, all of a sudden, it doesn't work and you have to drive on your own, but you never really drove on your own much because you always use the autopilot. Same thing for pilots. If you over-rely on the AI doing work for you, you might lose your natural human abilities to do a task like drive, fly a plane, or actually think about, does the diagnosis make sense or not? So our take on this is that we have to be really smart to develop AI in a way that it actually makes the human smart so that human can detect whether the AI is way on the mark or way off the mark.
That really makes a lot of sense, Dr. Papir. I think one example of de-skilling that a lot of people could relate to is you have some numbers in your phone that you just push one button and the entire phone number is dialed up without you having to do anything else, right?
Right, correct. And you don't remember the number anymore, right?
If you lose that phone or somebody says to you, come on, tell me, what's your wife's phone number? You might not remember it.
Correct. That is de-skilling. That's de-skilling your memory for something that you used to memorize.
Well, you know, this brings up a trip we made to the San Francisco Bay Area many, many years ago in the early days of GPS and map technology, and it had us driving into the bay.
We didn't, but that's what it was telling us to do.
And we were like, wait a minute, there's a lot of water out there, and it's going to keep on going. And So, you know, nowadays, it's much better technology, but I fear that a lot of people have lost the ability to even read a map because all they do is they put the address into their either their smartphone or into their car technology, and it tells them turn right here, turn left there. And if you gave them a map, they would like, well, how do I use it?
What's this thing? It's floppy and it's big and it's kind of, you know, unwieldy.
But you just mentioned Dr. Larry Weed. Can you give us a little history of Dr. Weed? Because in a sense, he was way out in front of all of the computers we have now and the artificial intelligence. He had a vision of how the technology could help health professionals and patients deal with diagnostic issues and treatment issues decades ago.
Well, you know, Joe and Terry, I've always believed that we haven't empowered people enough and patients enough. And I got that from working with Larry Weed. I mean, Larry Weed 50 years ago wrote books about how people needed to understand their medical record. They needed to read. They needed to become educated. And, you know, what he was saying 50 years ago resonates today. And I'm sure some people find this interesting. I call it the first TED Talk before there were TED Talks. A friend of Larry Weed's gave me the video of his 1971 grand rounds in internal medicine at Emory University. And we put it up on the internet. You can find it by going to Visual DX and or searching in Google, Larry Weed, Visual DX video, and you'll find a black and white 1 hour lecture. It really is the first TED Talk before there were TED Talks. And Larry was all about how people present to their doctors with symptoms. And we have to figure out how do we analyze these symptoms in a logical, thorough manner so that we can get to answers. And he was talking about patient empowerment, clinical reasoning, cognitive biases, premature closure, all these issues that we're talking about 50 years later in the patient safety movement. And, you know, obviously, Larry also realized you can't memorize it all and started talking about how we need to augment our intelligence. And now, 50 years later, you know, we're seeing incredible leaps and bounds in large language models and AI. And there are certainly clearly areas where AI is surpassing what humans can do. But there's a really important point underneath this all, and it has to do with the grayness and ambiguity of medicine. Medicine is not a Newtonian physics problem of how do we launch this rocket and think about all the vectors that go into the shape of the arc of a rocket mission where everything's known. Human biology is just full of unknowns and grayness. And Larry used to say, you have to tolerate the ambiguity. Like, don't make decisions too early. The answers will fall out over time. And often engineers approach medicine like it's an engineering problem. And that's why we have so many car crashes on the highway of technology development in medicine, because people approach medicine as an engineering problem, right? And, you know, we could do a whole show to talk about like why 23andMe filed for bankruptcy, had a valuation of, you know, $5 billion or something like that at some point. And if I can channel Larry Weed would say they made the fatal flaw of misstating the problem. Because genetics, it's really important to know if you have, you know, a certain gene that puts you at risk for, you know, BRCA for breast cancer or some gene that puts you at risk for a chronic illness. But in my 29 years practicing, I can't think of many instances where a genetic profile influenced my primary decision in the exam room of what's the diagnosis, what's the best test, what's the treatment. So we focused on genomics, but I think Larry would have argued that we needed to focus on clinomics, clinical medicine.
Exactly. I remember I was very impressed with his argument that, and we already have a situation in which if you go to the doctor, before you arrive at the doctor's office, they want you to check in and answer all kinds of questions. And most of the questions they want you to answer are about your insurance and how you're going to pay them. But Larry had envisioned a situation in which you would answer questions about your symptoms and you would fill in all that stuff. And the computer would then, when you showed up at the doctor's office, prompt the doctor with differential diagnoses. And the doctor would say, well, in order to figure this out, is it this or is it that? I need more information about XYZ. And that, it just was a very intriguing concept.
There's still so much to learn from Larry Weed and to look at advances in AI and hold it through a lens and to, you know, really pressure test whether we're using this brilliant new technology the right way, or is it actually going to reinforce errors in the exam room? Because it really, you know, you could use AI and it could tell you 96% it's this, and you just follow it blindly, and your patient actually is in the 4%, and you've done some real harm. So there are instances that the AI could encourage premature closure.
And we need to be careful not to step into that mistake. Dr. Papir, you established Visual DX partly because this vast library of images that are connected to diagnoses help people diagnose atypical presentations, or possibly typical presentations that they don't usually see. For example, a rash on dark skin. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would, please. And we only have 1 minute.
Well, Terry, you know, doctors like to say common things happen commonly. And if you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. In my career, most of the mistakes I did see were horses, but they were just different colored horses. In other words, we need to be able to move away from memorizing just the classic and think about the variants. Well, it turns out the variants of the common are what cause a lot more harm than missing super rare diseases. You know, a heart attack can present as a toothache or jaw pain. It's not the classic crushing chest pain, pain down the left arm. And so we can design these information systems, and this is what Visual DX has done with all this imagery, to show how skin diseases can look across different skin colors and different severities and really capture the great variety of human disease. And so that's what we focused on. And, you know, it's really a pleasure to have the opportunity to reconnect with you both. And I'm always available to pontificate on other subjects as well.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Art Papier. We really appreciate you talking with us on the People's Pharmacy today.
Joe and Terry, it's always been a pleasure to be on your show. I so appreciate the focus you've had over the decades, bringing better information to people in their homes and now on their mobile phones. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
You've been listening to Dr. Art Papier, dermatologist and medical informatics expert. Dr. Papier is the co-founder and CEO of Visual DX. He led the development of Visual DX, a professional point-of-care decision support system, as well as ASA, a freely available consumer and patient-facing AI app for dermatology. The URL is askasa.com. We spoke earlier with Dr. Jonathan Chen, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Stanford Medicine and the Center for Biomedical Informatics Research.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show. Al Wodarski engineered. Dave Graydon edits our interviews. BJ Lederman composed our theme music.
This show is a co-production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, with the People's Pharmacy.
Today's show is number 1434. You can find it online at peoplespharmacy.com. That's where you can share your comments about today's interview. You can also reach us through email, radio@peoplespharmacy.com.
Our interviews are available through your favorite podcast provider. You'll find the podcast on our website on Monday morning. On this week's podcast, you'll hear more about how machines can survey the world's medical literature and synthesize the findings so they're more accessible to researchers. We also talk more about misdiagnosis and how AI might help address that problem.
At peoplespharmacy.com, you can sign up for our free online newsletter to get the latest news about important health stories. When you subscribe, you also have regular access to information about our weekly podcast, so you can find out ahead of time what topics we'll be covering. Speaking of the podcast, we would be ever so grateful if you would consider writing a review of The People's Pharmacy and posting it to the podcast platform you prefer. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next week.